Welcome to Context, a podcast about the history behind current events in the Middle East. I'm Becky Nyman. Today's podcast episode deals with anti-Semitism, or in more direct terms, anti-Jewish hatred. This sentiment existed before Islam and before Christianity. In fact, anti-Jewish opinions were recorded in ancient Egypt, Greece, and Rome. Today, I'll be joined by Israeli cartoonist Yaakov Kirshen, creator of the Dry Bones comic strip. Dry Bones is internationally syndicated and has been in publication in the Jerusalem Post and other outlets for over 40 years. Dry Bones has been quoted or reprinted by the New York Times, Time Magazine, LA Times, Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Times of London, CNN, among others. In 2009, Kirshen was appointed a fellow and artist-in-residence at Yale's Initiative for the Interdisciplinary Study of Antisemitism. Kirshen wrote a Yale University paper on the use of anti-Semitic codes in political cartoons. If you've ever had a doubt about the power of cartoons, think back to the violent protests sparked by the cartoonists in Europe who drew their depictions of the Prophet Muhammad, or look even further back to Marie Antoinette, who was ultimately a victim of a very effective cartoon campaign. After my interview with Yaakov Kirshen, I'll be playing an audio segment from a classroom recording of my late father on the topic of historical anti-Semitism. But first, Yaakov Kirshen. Hello, Yaakov. Welcome to Context.
Hi there.
So I understand that you have an endeavor going on. You have an Indiegogo campaign, and it's directly concerning anti-Semitism and cartoons. Is that correct?
That's right. It's at Indiegogo, and it's called Help Fight Anti-Semitism with the Dry Bones Cartoon.
What makes the need for a new effort to fight anti-Semitism so important right now?
I think there's a lot of things going on in terms of anti-Semitism and what people perceive as a rise in anti-Semitism. And I think that the word anti-Semitism has begun to lose meaning, and maybe we should not be using it anymore and just call it the A word. Basically, the A word represents a rabid viral infection which has infected one movement after another. And like rabies, it takes over society, like a computer virus takes over your computer. The A word takes over cultures and civilizations and destroys them. When your pet dog gets rabies, that rabies infection takes over the behavior of the dog, and the dog is compelled to bite everything and anything in its path. It goes mad biting. Why does it bite? It bites because in the biting, it transfers the virus, and so that everything it bites becomes rabid and runs around biting. That's exactly what happens with a computer virus, so that your computer becomes infected, and instead of being able to do your normal computer work, your computer is reproducing more and more copies of that computer virus. And when you send out an email or when you put a flash drive, and what it does is it jumps to other people's computers, and the infection spreads and spreads until massive numbers of computers are infected with the virus. And when you have a viral infection like rabies, or a virus like Ebola, it goes from one host to another, and it spreads like wildfire. And anti-Semitism, being a behavioral virus, does the same thing. So when a movement becomes infected with viral anti-Semitism, it loses its way. It becomes compulsive in its attempt to spread that virus. So we know that the Nazis hated Jews and tried to destroy Jews and set up concentration camps and tortured and just were dedicated to the destruction of Jews. Well, the Nazis were the National Socialist Party. If I were to ask you what their programs were, what did they think about the means of production? What were their ideas that had nothing to do with Jews or Judaism? You can't tell me. Nobody can tell me. Because what happens was that, like rabies, they were taken over by the virus that they were infected with. We are witnessing today Islam being infected with viral anti-Semitism. So all we know is this insane, compulsive hatred of Israel and of Jews, people stabbing Jews and screaming, Allahu Akbar, God is great, Allah is great. But you're not seeing anybody talking about what are Allah's teachings, what are the teachings of the Quran, what is the message of Muhammad. All of that seems to have gone away in this frenzy of Jew hatred. We have witnessed that through a series of civilizations. Jews like us, we wrung our hands when Greek civilization fell to the Romans and the Romans fell to the barbarians and on and on and on. And we may be watching now the fall of European civilization as it is infected with this Islamic version of the anti-Semitic virus. Anti-Semitism in Europe is not out of control. It's now at a normal level. For a while, the Nazis gave anti-Semitism a bad name, but Europe has outgrown that, so they're all taken up with demonizing and delegitimizing us. The Indiegogo campaign is featuring a number of activities which I, as Dry Bones cartoonist, are deeply involved in. One is called Secret Codes Hidden War. So if you go to secretcodeshiddenwar.com, you will find a library compendium of the viral strains of anti-Semitism which infect cartoons.
Now, is this related to the project you did for Yale?
Yes. I was asked by Yale to do an examination of anti-Semitism, which, being a Jew and a cartoonist, I thought, this will be really easy. But then what I did was I started to collect anti-Semitic cartoons, hundreds and hundreds, and I began to connect the dots. What I found was that from the Nazis, through the fascists, through the communists, through skinheads, through Ku Klux Klan, up to contemporary Islamists, there were just three families of anti-Semitic images, viral images. And I wrote a working paper which was published by Yale University Press. And based on that working paper, I set up a compendium library so that folks can understand how that mechanism works in cartoons. Sort of like disease control. If you're dealing with a virus, you want to examine it and understand it and put it under a microscope. So that's one of the things that I am funding through the Indiegogo project.
I understand that there are certain images that reappear time and again in anti-Semitic cartoons. What are some of those major themes, and what was the earliest image you were able to find and analyze?
The oldest cartoon goes back to way pre-Nazi, where you have illustrations in church stained glass windows showing Jews drinking the blood of children. There were two families, two main strains of anti-Semitism. One attempted to say what Jews are, okay? And that is answered by saying Jews are not human. Jews are monsters. Jews have horns. Jews are vampires. What Jews are. And the second strain is what Jews do. And that is we control the banks, we control money, we start wars, we kill children, all like that. And those two strains of what we are and what we do together presented an image that threatened normal people. Because after all, the Jews are poisoning the wells, the Jews are killing children, and normal people in society being infected with this rabid belief system would attack the Jews. And we had pogroms, we had the slaughtering of Jews brought on by people who were afraid that they would be the victims of the Jews. And then along came the Holocaust, and when the Holocaust came along and everyone saw the pitiful Jews who had been the greatest victims of all time, that interfered with the spread of the virus. So anti-Semites, being stupid, started to say, the Holocaust didn't happen. 6 million weren't killed. It's all a lie. But a virus is smarter than that. What viruses do is viruses adapt. So the anti-Semitic virus, having those two strains, one is what Jews are and the other is what Jews do, developed a third strain, which was moral inversion. What that strain did was, it said, of course there was a Holocaust. Of course there was Nazis. Of course there were concentration camps. And you know what? The Jews did it. Gaza is a giant concentration camp. The Jews are Nazis. Israelis are Nazis. The Israeli army are a bunch of Nazis. And that is the way the strain, a new strain of anti-Semitism came up, which is widely believed. So these days, instead of us trying to explain that we don't kill Christian children to get their blood to make into matzah, today we have to explain that we don't bomb missile launchers in order to kill children. So we have had throughout the history of civilizations and throughout the history of the A virus, we have had to somehow defend ourselves. The amazing thing is that there are fewer than 40 images. Fewer than 40 images, and they are divided into three families. And if you take a person and you do a cartoon and you draw a big hook nose and then you put horns on the person and you have him holding a bag of money, bing, that's a Jew. And there are only 34 of those images, maybe 35. So if you want to know what they are, go to secretcodeshiddenwar.com and I've got them codified and listed there. But that's only one part of what it is that I'm trying to do through the Indiegogo project to properly fund a dry bones outreach.
What are some of the other aspects to the Indiegogo dry bones project?
Another aspect of the campaign is the cuckoos in our nest. When you hear the word cuckoo, it's sort of funny. It's like cuckoo, and here's a Swiss clock and a little clockwork bird jumps out. Well, that's not what a real cuckoo is. There's a cuckoo in nature, and the real cuckoo lays its egg in the nest of another bird. And then the innocent mama bird hatches the cuckoo's chick, and it treats it as one of its own. And then this murderous cuckoo chick, which grows bigger than the real babies, attacks the other chicks in the nest as they are hatched. We have cuckoos in our nest. We have Jewish professors. We have Jewish reporters. We have Jewish newsmen. We have Jews dressed in total religious garb who attack us, who spread the anti-Semitism. We have sexy, cute girl comedians who do campaigns saying Jews are racist and anti-black. These people get a pass because, after all, they're one of us. They're not one of us. They are the cuckoos in our nest. And it is important that we identify these archetypes of the cuckoos in our nest, i.e., the spreaders of the anti-Semitic virus who use their supposed Jewishness as a cover. So dealing with cuckoos in our nest is a second aspect of the Indiegogo Dry Bones project.
And how do you intend to deal with the cuckoos?
Well, the way I'm dealing with them, everything I do has to do with cartoons, and I'm producing the equivalent of cartoon collectible cards where we show a picture of that type of cuckoo and an explanation of what they do. Another aspect...
Like flashcards of cuckoos?
Yeah, yeah. So that they can be traded online and sent around. You know, what we are dealing with right now, and the reason that cartoons are becoming more and more important, is that we are in a post-literate period. It used to be that the world was bipolar. People were either literate or they were post-literate. Literate or illiterate. Post-literate didn't exist. Literate means that you can read and write. Illiterate means that you can't read and write. We have come to be post-literate. And post-literate means that we can read and write, but you know what? It's a lot of trouble. So it's much easier to listen to a podcast or to look at a cartoon than it is to read a long-winded email. So we all of us who are concerned about anti-Semitism have signed up for newsletters, and we get them in our emails, and we look at them, and we say, oh, I'm so glad he's doing that. But we don't take the time to read it. There's just so much text there. And this is one of the things that has made both podcasts and cartoons the preferred means of communication. And that's one of the reasons that Dry Bones has become so incredibly popular through Facebook, through Twitter, through blog, through all of it. People are looking at the cartoons on their phones, and they are sharing, and they are trading, and they are passing the message around. Another aspect of what I'm trying to do this leads to another aspect, which is something I call the Dry Bones Cartoon Academy. And that is, I need to pass on to young cartoonists the unique principles of cartooning that has guided my creation of Dry Bones cartoons for more than 40 years. This will include podcast lectures, competitions, internships, You know, cartoonists normally are taught how to draw the cartoon, but not to understand what that tool is. It's as if you teach people how to put a bullet in a gun and then set them loose and say, okay, honey, go out and start shooting. They need to understand what is the function of cartoon activism. They need to understand a number of things. One, they have to understand that their cartoons might be infected by the anti-Semitic viral infections that they'll learn from Secret Codes, Hidden War. But they need to understand also that every cartoon creates in the mind of the reader something I call the secret sentence. So when you do a cartoon and a person comes to the end of it, if it's a comic strip, or when they look at a one-panel cartoon, they get it right away, and that secret sentence is something they say in their mind. And they might be saying, Jews are bad. They might be saying, Jews love money. They might be saying all kinds of things. But most cartoonists haven't been trained in understanding that there is a hidden meaning that they are passing on. Young cartoonists are people who, when they were in school and the teacher was out of the room, they did a funny picture of the teacher on the blackboard, and they got the class to laugh. So they've grown up thinking that if they attack somebody, then they have done their job. Like comedians, they say, ah, this cartoon killed him. I knocked him dead. Right? Mm-hmm. I drew blood on that one. As if their goal is to do damage, rather than their goal should be to get a message under the radar into the minds of the people that you as an activist are trying to reach. So that is something I'm really dedicated to, the passing on and the teaching of young cartoonists as to exactly how to do that. Another part of what I'm doing in the Indiegogo project has to do with preserving the Judeo-Christian philosophy. And that's something that seems to be under attack also. When we see the total ignoring of the slaughter of Middle East Christians by Europeans, by organized churches, it's absolutely astounding. When is the last time you heard of a Christian church or a major Christian organization screaming about the slaughter of the Christian communities in Syria? You don't hear it. Not only that, the whole idea of Jews and Christians and what we share has totally disappeared. The whole idea of Christianity and Judaism sharing a unique vision, a vision which starts with a Garden of Eden at the beginning and goes through to an end which includes beating our swords into plowshares and studying war no more. What does it mean, beating our swords into plowshares? The Messianic age is when we are once again in a garden, when once again we are taking care of our trees. What does it mean that when we got a message from our God on Mount Sinai, that he spoke to us through a plant, through a burning bush, and that when we left Mount Sinai, we were instructed to create a symbol which we would carry with us. And that symbol was a golden tree with seven branches that would have lights, burning lights on the top of it. And we have carried that golden tree with us as a symbol for thousands of years. We call that golden tree the menorah. So the presentation of the whole Judeo-Christian unique ecological love of the planet and our place in bringing peace by planting trees, all of that has been covered up by the anti-Semitic, I should say the A word, which simply delegitimizes and defames us. When is the last time you heard about planting trees in Israel?
Well, actually, one of the most offensive things I've heard in the past few months was from a woman who told me that her husband said he wanted to return the tree that was given to him for his bar mitzvah, I suppose.
Right. Well, not only does he want to return the tree, but one of the major efforts of the anti-Semitic Islamists in Israel is to burn the trees. They are showing their love of the land by arson, by attacking our beloved trees. You know, I had a friend years ago who was a Christian, a Catholic monk, and he lived in Jerusalem, and there is a famous building called the Terra Sancta building, Holy Land building, which was owned by the Catholic Church. And in 1948, when Israel was established, he was in that church, and he was assigned the job to stay in that church so that it wouldn't be taken over as abandoned property. And I was friendly with this guy, and I was talking to him about being a Catholic monk living in Israel, and he explained to me that he often went off to Rome, and that when he was in Rome, known as the guy who was saving the Catholic building, he said often people would say to him, people meaning authorities and cardinals and priests of the Catholic Church, he would say, what are the Jews really like? And I said to him, what do you tell them? And he says, I always tell them they love their children and they love their trees. Okay? And the idea of somebody having been so infected by rabid anti-Semitism that he wants to return his tree is really, really pitiful.
Over the summer, was there a particular incident or image that crystallized for you the anti-Semitism inherent in the conflict?
Looking at a particular instance of it is like not seeing the forest for the trees. What that means is there is a forest. You need to see the forest. And somehow you don't see the forest because you're looking at the individual trees. We need to see the forest. So people who are concentrating on each individual thing are not seeing the forest because of the trees. So in the Indiegogo Dry Bones project, one part of the project is something called Trees, the Green Testament. And that was a graphic novel which reasserts the traditional Judeo-Christian idea in cartoon form, from the Garden of Eden at the beginning to the swords and plowshares, study war no more at the end. The story, it's the story of planet Earth and the Jewish people told from the viewpoint of the trees of Israel. I did this more than 20 years ago, and incredibly, the Wall Street Journal ran a front page story headlined, Israeli cartoonist becomes prophet to American Christians. People took this book to be a work of prophecy. And so up at Indiegogo, people can get a PDF version of that book and re-understand what Judeo-Christianity is all about.
I understand you traveled to China and you're working on comic books in Chinese in an effort, I guess, to reach Chinese-speaking people, the Chinese nation.
Right. It's hard to say what China is. China is a vast area, and there is something called Signal, which is a Sino-Israeli academic liaison NGO. And I've become a senior fellow of that organization. And as such, I started by doing a first comic book for the Chinese, and that has expanded to where I now regularly meet with senior Chinese politicians and academicians as they visit Israel. So Signal uses me as a means of communicating with these people. Another thing that I'm doing is that we have an archive of more than 7,000 cartoons. 7,000 cartoons. I've been doing Dry Bones without a break as a daily comic strip since January 1st, 1973. And so we have a digital high-res library of those cartoons. But we need to update and improve our library software. So Indiegogo is looking for funds to do all of these things. And in parallel, we are looking for major donors who don't want to take the Indiegogo route, who will seriously back us. You know, our Jewish organizations each started as a reaction to anti-Semitism. In the 1800s, there was virulent French anti-Semitism. Everybody knew it. But until there was a court case, until there was the Dreyfus case, a journalist named Herzl focused on that and realized that something had to be done. And he started an organization with a World Zionist Congress. And that turned into the World Zionist Organization, the WZO, which exists to this day. And it does all kinds of good things. But in terms of combating what we're facing, it's irrelevant. And in the early 20th century in the United States, there was, of course, tremendous anti-Semitism. But there was a particular court case with a guy named Leo Frank. And Leo Frank in the South was accused of killing a little Christian white girl. And he was convicted of murder and he was sentenced to death. And it was obviously simple anti-Semitism. And therefore, the governor commuted his sentence so that he would not be executed. This so enraged the local population that they broke into his jail cell and lynched him. Well, the people who tried to fight against the anti-Semitic railroading of Leo Frank set up an organization, and that was the Anti-Defamation League. And the ADL exists to this day. Well, we need a new organization. And that new organization is going to be Dry Bones. And it's going to take a lot more money than we can raise through an Indiegogo project. So we need major, major funding. It's going to take a couple million dollars to set up what needs to be set up. And that's going to take real angels. That's going to take the kind of people who would back the WZO or the ADL people who will back a real dry bones operation. But the first step is Indiegogo, and that is to involve normal walking around people to join us, to become members, to get a Haggadah or two, to get a copy of Trees, to get a membership card, to become part of this, and to get us started.
So what is the best way to deal with this virus?
I think that when it comes to dealing with rabid viral anti-Semitism, that humor and cartoons is a good way to survive, along with reading our Haggadahs and understanding. Telling the pogrom mob that we didn't kidnap and kill little Christian children, telling the pogrom mob that we didn't poison the wells, is as useless as telling the CNN reporter that we didn't target children in Gaza. It's useless. Absolutely useless. These people are infected. These people are foaming at the mouth. We are not going to stop the anti-Semitism by showing them that they are wrong. In addition, showing people how wonderful Jews are by, look how many Nobel Prizes we won. Look how we've done all of this, all the startups we do, all of the wonderful things that show we are superior. That doesn't help. You know, Mark Twain, when he was a journalist, once got a question as to why do people hate the Jews. And he wrote a very interesting column in a newspaper, and he explained a very interesting point, and that is anti-Semitism expressed itself by denying Jews the right to have farms, denying Jews the right to go to schools. Well, he said, if you thought that Jews were inferior, you would let them go to the schools because they would fail. If you thought Jews were inferior, you'd let them set up farms because they wouldn't be able to farm. Part of anti-Semitism is belief in Jewish superiority. You've got to kill the Jews because they are smarter and better than you, and they are threatening you. You are a regular person, and those wicked, evil, demonic Jews, they're smart. They control the media. They control the governments. They're in league with the devil. They are magically superior. So every time we point out our superiority, all we're doing is fanning the flames of anti-Semitism. We address the issue of anti-Semitism by reading our secret book, by passing on to our next generation, whether they are wise, the wicked, the simple, or those who don't know to ask, the lessons of the Haggadah. And each wave of anti-Semitism eventually destroys the entity that has used it. The Nazis became nothing but anti-Semites, and the world finally had to fight and destroy them. Islamism has become the equivalent of Nazis. They have taken over Islam, and they went from setting off suicide bombs in Israel to setting off suicide bombs across their own world, and the lands of Islam are flowing with much more blood than the Jewish state. the rabid anti-Semitism is destroying them, and eventually it will burn them out, and we may see the fall of European civilization, and it might be replaced with an Islamic civilization, which, if it is replaced, will either lose its anti-Semitism and calm down, or it will self-implode. The Middle East used to have three hopes for a secular peace. One was Muslim, and that was Turkey. One was Christian, and that was Lebanon. And one was Jewish, that was Israel. It was a three-legged stool. And the Turkish leg has been burnt off, and the Christian leg of Lebanon has been burnt off. And the hope for the Middle East rests now on one leg, and that is the Jewish state. We are next door to the Egyptians, who are valiantly fighting against the Islamism. They are engaged in a major, largely unreported war against Islam. They are fighting the Islamic tunnels that are coming out of Gaza into Sinai, just the way the Islamic tunnels threaten the Jewish state, they threaten the Egyptian state. And hopefully our understanding with the Egyptians will, back to back, we will be able to fight off the rabid dogs of anti-Semitic Islamism. So that's where we are, and that's the situation. Hopefully people listening to this will get onto their computers and pop into Google and list Indiegogo dry bones. And if you add anti-Semitism, you're sure to get to it.
Thank you very much for joining me here on Context, Yaakov.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
The following segment is an excerpt from a course my father gave on the history of the church and the Jews. This portion deals with anti-Semitism in the early Christian church.
The leaders of the Jewish community, the religious leaders, and they call them the illustrious patriarchs and synagogue, archi-synagogo. Archi-synagogos means president of the synagogue or head of the synagogue, shall be respected. Anyone who insults them shall be severely punished. Even that, well, that's quite a status to have in a Christian world where the Constitution says, yes, the Jews are sinners and therefore are condemned by God, and they are people who are inferior to the Christians. Not only that, a Jew cannot be superior to a Christian in many ways. That is a kind of a law which can be interpreted in many ways, and it is in the course of time. If a Jew cannot be superior to a Christian, that makes it possible for a Christian government to confiscate Jewish property. And they've done it many times. Time and time again, as we know in history, especially in the 20th century, and before the expulsion from Spain, the King Ferdinand and Isabella confiscated all Jewish property, all Jewish money, and then they just threw them out of the country. And this is in accordance with Christian law. So there are many elements in it, but what's most interesting is that according to the Constitution of the Roman Empire, when it becomes Christian, Jews are to be protected. That is the law, and that's the theory. In practice, what happens? Well, you have hostility, and hostility breaks out. And the hostility breaks out in many different forms. First of all, as I mentioned, there's a national hostility. These Jews are people are Jews, and we're Romans and Greeks. There's a difference. There's a touch of hostility there, which is expressed even in the pre-Christian period. Then you have the Christian attitude, which is the Jews are condemned because they're sinners. They didn't accept Christianity. Then you have another factor. And this, I suppose, the economic determinists would call this class struggle factor. Namely, what? The poor against the rich. Poor is a relative term. What does poor mean? It depends on where you are and what you're talking about. What does rich mean? It means many things. The Talmud says, who is rich? The person who says, I've got enough. Whatever I have is enough. Well, that's a good state of mind. Therefore, according to the Talmud, I guess a man like Donald Trump would be poor because he's never satisfied. Never satisfied. So that's why the Talmud says, Ezehu ashira sameach b'chalko. Who is rich? The person who says, you know, I'm happy, I got enough. In other words, rich and poor is a state of mind, and it's also a social situation, how people react to their particular condition. And I'm pointing this out because Jews have a certain attitude, which is general among the Jewish people, and that is to try to establish yourself, to have a labor or a profession, to maintain your family, to marry, settle down, have children, raise your children, provide them with an education. In other words, there are certain ways of living which became habitual among the Jewish people, and they are habitual among the Jewish people in general. I suppose other people have that too, but many people don't. So when you look upon the Jewish community, and you look upon them in a certain way, and your community is different, you may find a reason for dissatisfaction. Now, I want to tell you something very interesting. I'll quote another church father. There was a man by the name of John Chrysostom, Saint John Chrysostom. He was called John Chrysostom because those words in Greek mean golden-tongued. This man had a golden tongue. He was a great preacher, and he wrote a lot. We have a lot of the works that he wrote, and he was a great preacher. But Saint John Chrysostom had a passionate hatred of the Jewish people. Like, he was really personally so resentful of the Jews. And of course, he had the Christian elements in it, other things about him. But you know, when he talks about the Jews, he says very strange things. He says, on the one hand, these Jewish people, they're so materialistic. Look at them. They like to eat. They like to have a lot of children. I mean, these people are obsessed with the material things in life. And then he says at another time, look at the Jewish people. They take care of their families. They educate their children. They make sure that everyone in the family is taken care of. Why can't you Christians be the same? In other words, on the one hand, he's saying, look at the Jews. They lead a sober life. Look at you Christians. You're not doing the right thing. And then he says, and the Jews are such terrible people because they're so materialistic. John Chrysostom represents something. He represents this ambivalence. On the one hand, admiration for the Jewish people. On the other hand, condemning the Jewish people. It's as if he can't make up his mind and he can't really rest on it. And then he does other terrible things. He once preached a very violent sermon against the Jews and aroused his congregation. And they rushed out of the church and they ran over to the Jewish community and they began to destroy and to burn and do terrible things. So the police went over to him and they said, what are you doing? So he said, well, I was just preaching a sermon. I was just talking. I didn't tell them to go out. There was one man, a church father by the name of Marcion, in the year 190, who wrote an entirely new Bible, which he said, this is purely Christian. We have no relationship to the Jews. The Old Testament has nothing to do with us. He wrote that, and he founded his own form of Christianity, which was without Judaism. And the rest of the bishops of the church condemned him. They said, this guy is nuts. He's a heretic. He believes falsely. No, the obligation of the church is to protect the Jews. It doesn't mean they've always done it, and they haven't done it successfully. And some of the popes were very bad when it came to that, and they didn't fulfill their role. But if you read, Pope Martin V, he feels that the Jews deserve protection. When you read the works of Gregory the Great, and even the things that were done in the Renaissance of the Pope of Leo X, I would say John XXIII II, I mean John XXIII of our own time. I mean, this man, he didn't say it openly. He wasn't ready to say Pope Pius XII was a collaborator with the Nazis, But when Ralph Hochhuth wrote his play, The Deputy, in which he showed that Pope Pius XII collaborated with the Nazis, and somebody said to Pope John XXIII, you know, you should condemn that play. So he said, why? Why should I condemn the truth? In other words, he knew that there were certain things that were done which were wrong, but why should the church believe that the Jews have to be preserved? It's self-preservation. A true Christian knows you cannot get rid of the Jews. We depend on them. This is Christian faith. Of course, there were some who felt, yeah, we can get along without the Jews too. I mean, Martin Luther believed that they could get along without the Jews, and others did later. And of course, when we get to the 20th century, we have a lot of Christians who say, yeah, we can get rid of all the Jews, just as a lot of Europeans are saying today. And when you ask why, it's because in Christian theology, this is essential. It's as if Christians cannot conceive of themselves as being legitimate without the background and the foundation of Judaism, which is in it. So if you read the New Testament, you'll see the Bible, the Jewish Bible, is quoted constantly. And not only that, many times they say things which are in the Jewish Bible, and they don't say, it's written there. It's, they just say it. It's part of their language. Not only that, but when you read the sayings of Jesus and Paul, you can see that they are saying things which are in the Talmud, which means right in conformity with Jewish law at that time. And they agree with so much of Jewish law at that time. So there is an intimate bond between Judaism and Christianity, and it's difficult for many of us to realize that because so many Christians have violated that bond time and time again.
That was Dr. David Nyman on anti-Semitism. The audio segment you just heard was taken from the audiobook The Church and the Jews. Thank you for listening to Context, the podcast. You can follow the Context blog on the Times of Israel website, and please visit drdavidnyman.com for more audio, video, and other fascinating information.